Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first Jews came about 2,000 years ago to France. There's been a lot of eating and cooking since then. Kosher butchers serving whole French towns, yeshiva teachers moonlighting as truffle hunters, old Jewish traditions, Ashkenazi and Sephardic, woven into the fabric of French cuisine, and vice versa. This hour on Point, Joan Nathan takes us on a cook's tour of the Jewish cooking of France. You can join the conversation. Do you know the history, the food? Have you had it? Have you cooked it? Are you looking for a special recipe for Hanukkah? You can comment on our website as well, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, and let us know your city and state when you comment online. Joining me now in the studio, and I'm very happy to have her, is Joan Nathan, James Beard award-winning author of 10 cookbooks on American, Jewish, and Israeli cuisine, author of Jewish Cooking in America and the Jewish Holiday Kitchen. Her latest combination cookbook and cultural history is Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. It's just out. We'll be tasting four recipes from the book during the show, and you can find them at our website, onpointradio.org. Joan Nathan, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What a wonderful book. I got really revved up looking through the photography. You know, it's not fancy. It's kind of like a lot of the French settings, and in a way, even the cooking, it catches this sort of rustic appeal of this cuisine. You've got a long personal connection to this realm. You are American front to back, but this didn't happen yesterday. Your interest in France and French cuisine and the Jewish thread therein.
Right. Well, I went to France the first time when I was about 17 years old. My father was German-born. Mm-hmm. He felt that I should go and learn a foreign language. So I went to Annecy, where I had relatives from Germany. And I visited them. I had a meal. I remember this meal so exactly.
Okay.
And Annecy is a very beautiful town near a lake. I don't know if you've been there. It's near Geneva. It's one of the most beautiful towns in France. And we were sitting near the lake where they lived, and they brought out this lunch. And it was celery remoulade and carrot râpé and a beautiful potato salad. And I thought to myself, this is really heaven. So I ate all those dishes, thinking that was the whole meal, and then they brought the soup, and then they brought the stuffed veal,
yeah,
and the dessert, and of course I gained about 20 pounds that summer.
Doubt.
But my love affair with France has been ever since.
You were there, not far from Geneva, also spent time with families in Paris, the serfs there.
Right.
C-E-R-F-S.
Exactly. And I visited them. They were a Jewish family, originally from both Alsace and Lorraine.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of them as French. I didn't think Jewish for anybody. These were all Jewish people. But I was into French, and it wasn't really till later that I suddenly realized, wait a minute, there's French Jewish cooking. People are much more reserved in France. They don't talk about their backgrounds. And people, you know, this wasn't so far from World War II, so
mm-hmm.
they really...
There may be reasons for that.
There were reasons for that in mm-hmm. France. Not, you know, as I tell some of my friends, it's not like being a New York Jew in France.
Right out there, flying the flag.
Right, exactly. In France, you're much more reserved, and not just France. I think most countries in the world, when you're Jewish, it's a little bit under the radar. You really don't talk about it as much. And also, the French are so much more reserved. They don't really talk about themselves either, or their own backgrounds, unless they're, you know, a comte of somebody, that they're from an aristocratic family.
I mean, it even goes to their identity. You write, I later discovered that Jews like my family in Annecy and the serfs in Paris were shocked to be thought of as Jews and not simply as French people. For American Jews, this may be a news bulletin.
Right, exactly. And for years, nobody talked about what they were. But I went to the serfs for holidays, and I loved the food. But it never occurred to me to write about that food.
Mm.
You know, it was the same as my house in when I was growing up mm-hmm. in Providence, Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
Now I live in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so different. First of all, it was in French. You know?
Of course.
But the meals, there was also that beautiful élan and that beautiful style at a French meal. And, of course, you know, you didn't dig in. You ate and discussed, you didn't discuss food, but you talked. It was civilized.
Well, that's always very nice. and on Fridays, maybe this is a Sabbath meal. You write about chicken consommé with matzo ball, so it's not as though it's, you know, it's hard.
But dainty matzo balls.
Okay, dainty. Or even better, you write tiny marrow dumplings. Never had that. What's a marrow? Just bone marrow dumplings.
Right. Well, that's exactly what matzo balls originally were. They would take the bone marrow. Instead, if they didn't use chicken fat, they would use bone marrow, and they would put them in with matzah. Not matzah meal, but they would be broken up matzahs.
Veal breast stuffed and golden brown potatoes and wine, but not Manischewitz.
Exactly. Never. never. And even the wine, and Jewish wine in France is different. Since the 16th century, the Grand Rabbin of Bordeaux, the great rabbi of Bordeaux, part of his job description has been to be in charge of koshering wine, so that people come to wineries in France and that are not Jewish wineries at all, that are not kosher wineries. Right. And there's a négociant who speaks to them and said, look, if we buy 3,000 bottles of your or a run of your wine and make it kosher, is that a, you know, we will guarantee that we'll sell 3,000. However, you have to help us. And the way that they have to help them is to oversee the wine, as to make sure it's the best quality wine that they do. So that means...
Is that all it means to be kosher wine, is to
be top
quality?
No. From the winery, the owner of the winery must watch to make sure that it's his best quality. Mm-hmm. However, there's a mashgiach, somebody who watches over it, who's a Sabbath observant Jew. So nobody can touch wine while it's being processed unless you are a Sabbath observant Jew.
Okay, if you want it to be kosher at the other end.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So what happens is not only the Sabbath in the middle of the wine season, but there are two Jewish holidays that are two, maybe 3 days apiece, which is Sukkot and Simchas Torah. So that means that the wine cannot be touched during that time. And you can imagine the winemakers, they're going crazy. So what they've done is today they take these very cold, like ice cubes, but they're not ice cubes, to slow down the fermentation because nobody can touch the wine.
And sort of put it on ice, literally there.
Right, exactly.
Very nearly. 2,000 years of Jewish history in France. Take us back just a little to the beginning of that. It becomes vivid to many people closer to World War II and a very difficult time. But if you go all the way back, you say they came with the Romans.
They came with the Romans. And some people think maybe before, because I think Jews have always been not only wanderers, but they've been merchants. And they've been looking for new items.
On a shared Mediterranean.
Exactly, on a shared Mediterranean. So that with the destruction of the Second Temple, Jews went to Rome with the Romans, and then they came to Catalonia, which at that time was neither France nor Spain.
So we're talking here about year 70, Christian era.
Right, exactly, or afterwards. Mm-hmm. And they came to southern France. Now, there was no Ashkenazic or Sephardic food in those days. It was Jewish food. So that they came not only to Italy, our Italy now, and our Spain now, but also to France, to around the Mediterranean. And they brought with them the food that everybody was eating then. Flatbreads that they would put onions on it, or they would put olive oil on it. Olive oil, you know, they had that from ancient Israel and also from around the Mediterranean. Wine, chickpeas, lentils, fava beans. These were the foods of the Mediterranean. And, you know, and occasionally there's wild fennel in the south of France. And there was spinach. There were different things that would be eaten. But this was the main food. That was bread. And then, of course, they would have stews for the Sabbath when you would have a meat stew.
They came and they met the Gauls. I mean, there was clearly there was a big tradition since prehistory here already. And many places along the line, you get a kind of fusion, a deep meeting.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to think, not just, I learned so much writing this book, not just about Jewish food, but just about all of our food and how it really developed in France, and because France was the richest agricultural country of Europe.
Still is.
It still is, exactly. And so that you know, it was a wonderful place to develop cuisine for everybody. And so Jewish merchants went out. There was a band of merchants called the Radenites that we have a record of it from the 8th century. My guess is it was earlier. Mm-hmm. And they would, they're not sure if the center of it was near Narbonne mm-hmm. or if it was in Baghdad, but they went to Russia, to China, to India.
So it all gets folded in here as it moves.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, in your title, you're talking about your search for Jewish cooking. I mean, it wasn't just all lying right out there and obvious.
Not at all. It was very... When I first interviewed or talked to my cousins, nobody talked about even being Jewish. And it wasn't until I went back about 10 years ago. I've been going back forever. But then people started lightening up and talking about their backgrounds. And I think a lot of them not only came of age, but it was easier. It was after World War II, way after World War II.
World War II won some 80,000 French Jews had been killed
taken
in concentration
camps. Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And people came, but the population increased in France. Today it's the third largest Jewish population in the world, 600,000 Jews.
So what, U.S. and Israel and France?
Israel first, U.S., and then France. Mm-hmm. And of that, almost 250,000 came after World War II from North Africa. These were North African Jews, many of whom were probably their ancestors were the first Jews that came to France because they were around the Mediterranean. They came from Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco.
The Sephardic
Jews.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are taking a cook's tour of the Jewish cooking of France today. Hanukkah starts tomorrow. We are on the road today in the highways and byways, back roads of France with Joan Nathan. Her new book is Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. And it is pretty terrific, both for the recipes, quite wonderful, but also for the cultural history here, which is really something to take on board. She joins us in the studio today. You can join us on the air as well. How's this for a Sabbath dinner? Chicken Provençal, salade juvie, babka à la française. We've got that and much more coming. What's your question for Joan Nathan on how Jewish food traditions live in France? We've got food on the table now and much more. We're going to dive right in. J.J. Gonson is with us as well. She's a locavore based in Boston, founder of Cuisine and Locale, a personal chef service. Everybody loves it. J.J., welcome back. Thanks for doing this cooking for us.
Thank you, Tom.
This is gorgeous, and the studio suddenly smells wonderful. But before we take our pleasure, let's go to our listeners. Philippe is calling from Boston. Philippe, you're on the air with Joan Nathan.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Very well.
Listen, first of all, I love your show. I listen to it religiously, but this has got to be one of the most near and dear topics to my heart.
Tell us.
I am French. I was born in Paris. My mom was born in Casablanca. Uh-huh. I have very deep roots in the Sephardic traditions of France. Still have family in Algeria, in Morocco, and in Lebanon. So, I mean, I'm just like beyond words right now.
This is made for you, Philippe.
This is absolutely made for me. So my question, though, is, first of all, I'm excited. I already just bought the book. I'm looking forward to getting it. And Joan, thank you for creating this. But I'm thinking also two things. First of all, France, as you know, Joan, is increasingly becoming a cultural melting pot, much like the roots of the U.S. in and of itself. So I would love to get your comments and thoughts on how that is changing French cuisine. And, you know, I love dafina, I love harira, and you know, all the traditional Moroccan things, but I still can't find also, beyond your book, any great recommendations on a true Moroccan Sephardic cookbook that is available in the United States. And I would love to get your thoughts on both of those things.
Well, that's a tall order. Okay, first of all, I agree with you that it is becoming increasingly a melting pot, but I think that it's always been a melting pot and that they might not have been on this this amount of integration, but they're, you know, even French Jews and French non-Jews, they're not always French, and they all come from somewhere else. But that said, if you go to markets today in France, you will find the North African influence everywhere. You can get harira. You can get za'atar. Harira is a hot spice, a pepper spice sauce that is Tunisian.
Mm-hmm.
You can get the kinds of beans, the kinds of fish that's flown in directly from Tunis, because people love this kind of, I think there's a special grouper that's from Tunis. They've been North Africanized. Even Bocuse's restaurants, his little bistros mm-hmm. in the south of France, I mean in Lyon, have all a North African flavor to them. And lots of three-star restaurants are now making couscous, tagines,
What's a tagine for our listeners who may not?
Tagine is it's like a ceramic cooking vessel,
mm-hmm.
and you cook chicken or meat very, very slowly,
mm-hmm.
and it's Moroccan.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're definitely, definitely in France. But there have always been these influences. You take eggplant caviar, which is in my book. Of course, I have a Jewish version. However, there were lots of Russians and Romanians that came over in the 19th century, just as there were Eastern Europeans that came to the United States. You know, France was really the old promised land, just as we are the new promised land.
I've got a note here from Fatima in Savannah, Georgia, and she says, what do you mean couscous Jewish coming from North Africa? A lot of North Africans who are not Jewish obviously came to France,
right.
Long colonial and trade history there.
Absolutely.
What North African influence is Jewish in particular, or can you sort it out?
No, you can't sort it out. It's North African influence. She's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
You can sort it out in a home mm-hmm. with their specifically Jewish dishes. For example, Philippe, I'll bet you your mother makes 25 salads on Friday night, and if she doesn't, you're probably very upset. This is typically North African, and it's something that children look for and look forward to. But it's at home cuisine, so mm-hmm. But even so, that the harissa, the different sauces that you'll get, everybody will get in the marketplaces because mm-hmm. you go to marketplaces.
Mm-hmm. That's a public French thing to do.
That's exactly. It's the right. public space. But private space in France is much more private than in the United States.
We'll come to that, and I want to hear much more on the history front, but let's get to this food as well.
Yum.
JJ's been good enough to bring it in. And we've been talking the Sephardic tradition and thread here, but there's the Ashkenazi as
Absolutely.
Well, and I think maybe we've got some of that here. There's a JJ, what have you got from Joan's book? There's an Alsatian Kugel with pear and prunes, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is a lot gooier than what I'm used to seeing. More fruit going on.
It right. actually looks gooier because it's got the compote on top of it.
Oh, I
if
see.
If you look to the side, one half of it I left dry, so you can kind of get both bites.
What's so, okay, I'm digging in.
I want to see what you like about this.
Well, what's not to like?
And this is really a bread pudding, which
yes,
is really what
that.
The original...
Any New Englander would recognize right. that and this right away.
Well, you know, strangely, I was in New Orleans last week, and I realized that this is like a New Orleans bread pudding. But it would make sense because so many Alsatians and Laurentians went to, not just Jews, I mean, when mm-hmm, I'm saying mm-hmm, that, mm-hmm. they went to Louisiana. However, what makes this Jewish mm-hmm. is the sautéed onions. This is a savory dish that would go next to the pot au feu for the Sabbath.
The pot au feu, the little pot of kind of a stew.
Right. It's a stew that would
pot
cook
pot.
Overnight.
Mm-hmm. Crock pot.
A crock okay. pot stew, but it would cook in the oven. This is mm-hmm. this goes back maybe the 10th, 11th century.
That's savory and sweet together. I mean, the compote on top with the pears and prunes, so sweet and wonderful, and the texture is so great. I love the two together. That's
right.
just fantastic. Fantastic.
And of course, again, this is regional because the pears and the prunes were very, plums, excuse me,
yes.
were very well known in Alsace. And so they would make this with fresh pears and plums in the late fall. And then, of course, dried pears and plums in the winter.
Give us the history, the cultural geography here of Ashkenazi and Alsace.
Well, what's fascinating is the beginning of Alsatian food. Remember I was talking about around the Mediterranean, it was just Jewish food.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the Jews went north. As they were merchants, they went to find more...
You're saying originally, sort of out of Israel, way, way, way back.
Yeah, there was
it was
no
just what they brought and ate. And
right,
saying,
exactly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then they went to... some moved to, like, the Rabbi Rashi moved mm-hmm. to Troyes. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of Jews by the... Not a lot, but, you know, they weren't that many. By the 10th century, went to Ashkenaz, which was a valley between... France, now in Germany. Mm-hmm. So it's southern Germany and France. And they couldn't get the olive oil from the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get the fresh, warm vegetables from the Mediterranean all year round. Mm-hmm. So they started using sauerkraut, and they started using goose fat. And, of course, Ashkenazic food was born. And you can tell, for example, the word kugel is a German word. So it means round. And kugel started in this valley. And then it went east to Poland and to Eastern Europe. And then it came back in different guises through the civilization. So when potatoes hit Europe, you get potato kugel. When noodles were – a lot of noodles were used very early. It's delicious. And it's the onion makes it savory.
Oh, yeah. J.J. Gunson, what about this kugel with this compote and the whole thing going on here compared to what you see kind of as a – pardon me, mouthful – but the standard kugel that gets – punched out in the U.S.
Well, my mom's kugel was always a noodle kugel, and it was very different. It was very cheesy and sweet, kind of almost like a farmer's cheese. I'm not sure. This is what I remember from my childhood, was this kind of eggy, cheesy, noodly thing. And one of the things I love about this is that you bake it and bake it and bake it, and it gets this wonderful crisp, caramelized. Oh, yeah. The combination of the onions that you just start sautéing and then baking and baking.
It's fantastic.
Yeah,
let me get a call right here. Lori in Pocosin, Virginia. Lori, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm originally from South Louisiana, lived 20 years in New Orleans, which of course is super French, and has a much larger Jewish population than you think.
Great.
And kept a kosher kitchen for years. And my question is, it's intriguing to me that the first vegetable out of your mouth was carrots.
This is Joan talking.
Carrots. I would never think of making a chicken matzo soup without slicing in some carrots.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
I would never think of throwing together a kugel, and there are lots of them, without some shredded carrots.
Well, don't shred them in this kugel. Make it without the carrots. But carrots are, well, it's a universal dish. I mean, a universal vegetable. And my guess that they were there way, way back in France. But the carrots that I – of course, they're in stews, but they're also in North Africa, has wonderful vegetables with them and salads with them, and so do the French, but raw, of course.
Well, I could just keep eating it. But thank you so much, Lori, for your call. I mean, there's that French connection you're talking about right there. What about the – I don't know, the effect of the war?
Well, the effect of the war was really so huge. I mean,
did Jewishness go underground?
Absolutely, Jewishness went.
And with it, the food or no?
No,
or?
No. The food never goes underground with Jewish families. I mean, this apple cake recipe, for example, was a woman who was a hidden Jew during the war. I mean, she isn't the cake, but
this is a. We'll get to it. This is a Hanukkah cake.
This is a Hanukkah cake.
Gato Hanukkah.
And I interviewed people that were hidden during the war, lots of them. I have a lot of stories, as I do in all my books. And this woman, her daughter came up to me when I was at a bat mitzvah in Geneva, and she patted me on the shoulder, and she heard me talking about my book, and she said, please interview my mother. She doesn't tell us about recipes or about her time in the war, but if you come over, I know, and cook with her, I'll get the recipes and we'll get the stories too. And that's exactly what she did. And she made this gâteau de Hanukkah not as beautifully as JJ did. She made it in a battered 9x13 pan, and she said that's what her mother did, and so that's what she wanted to do.
We're saving that for the last. You mentioned.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay,
that's all right. We'll enjoy it. But you mentioned goose fat used by the Ashkenazi, and there we come to foie gras in France, and the kind of association between French Jews who very often raised the geese and produced the foie gras, and because they needed that as an alternative to olive oil.
Oh, and also they couldn't use lard.
Lard, which was the local sort of lubricant.
Right, because Jews can't eat pork. So they, but not only that, I mean, these were not big merchants. These were small merchants. And what they did was they raised the geese. Geese don't take a lot of land. They didn't have a lot of land. They raised the geese. They used the fat. The foie gras fetched a lot of money. And the quills they could use for pens, and the feathers for pillows and for covers. So that's what they did. And Rashi, the rabbi Rashi, said in the 10th century, he wrote, that Jews will be punished for their practice of foie gras because he thought force-feeding was so cruel to the animals.
Yeah.
And rabbis throughout history,
mm-hmm.
especially in Hungary, have said, don't do it. But, of course, they did it.
French Jews and non-Jews alike, yeah, it may not be the kindest thing, but it sure can be tasty. JJ, what else have we got here? A chicken fricassee? Is that what I said?
Friday night chicken.
And this is an Algerian recipe.
Oh, this is beautiful. Yellow.
With saffron.
It was a saffron mm-hmm. and lemon. Is that lemon peel on
lemon
top?
Lemon rind.
It's yep. very lemony.
It's very lemony.
All right. I'm digging in. It's Friday night. We're somewhere in France. And
the peppers
and we're happy.
Are actually from Bordeaux. My garden.
Well, let me get a little red. Oh, this is a little red pepper?
It's spicy. Be careful.
Okay. I'll be careful. Tell us about this one, Joan.
Well, this is a recipe from Algeria that a woman in France made her whole life. And she grew up with this after all those many salads in a North African home.
Yes.
She had this as the main Friday night dish. And, you know, children love repetition of recipes, so they were comforting for you. And,
of course, but fricassee, I think of that in American cooking as kind of having milk involved.
Not necessarily.
Okay. So what does fricassee mean here?
Well, fricassee really here means sort of fried, and it was like mm-hmm. a fancy way of calling it fricassee. That's the way she called it, so that's the way I called it.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of a, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, please correct me, poulet en pot? When you take a whole chicken, and I actually kind of loved this from the perspective of what we were talking about, because it was the kind of dish that my bubby would have prepared.
Mm-hmm.
It also is very, to me, very French to take a whole lemon and involve it with a lot of chicken in a pot that's covered tightly like
right.
that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, to me, and then throwing the saffron and skewed it. So it sort of brought all these cultures together, and it's delicious.
Such a nice, puts a nice tone under the whole thing.
And that's also, wonderful. I think a Jewish woman, when she's making chicken mm-hmm. soup, mm-hmm. would cut off the breast mm-hmm. to make it for the main course, for a special mm-hmm. main course.
Right,
and
right.
Friday night was mm-hmm. the special night.
Joan, can you pass the potato salad?
Absolutely.
And what potato salad is this?
Well, this is, again, an Alsatian potato salad, mm-hmm. and it's lemony, but there's oil. Again, it's very simple. And, you know, I think it's interesting that we would think of potatoes just fried for latkes, for Hanukkah.
Right.
But the French might have this at Hanukkah because there's oil in it. It's not necessarily they feel that it has to be fried in oil. Again, this is a tradition.
Oil and Hanukkah tied, of course, because of the tradition of Hanukkah and the oil that burned and burned.
Right, exactly. But the French would not necessarily think that they had to have potato pancakes at Hanukkah.
It could be potato salad, but this is not the French way with bacon,
no,
obviously.
Exactly, obviously. Exactly. There's
so
lardon.
So the Jewish spin here is take that out. Is there a substitute, JJ, or is it just?
I think to a degree the vinegar is the dominant flavor that's mm-hmm. been replacing mm-hmm. the lardon.
Right.
And yeah.
Shallots, parsley,
and
very fresh.
Very wonderful shallots, mm. yep.
And don't forget, they've never tasted the lardon, or at least not at their home, so mm-hmm. they don't really need it. And they would, you know, and it might have been a long time ago. They might have put a little bit of smoked goose breast in there.
Hmm. Are there delis in France? I mean, can you go and find sort of Jewish cooking at the corner deli?
Not like America. Don't forget, the delis, as we know them, were invented in America.
Mm-hmm.
And
but is there any sort of other French Jewish food shops where you can
yes,
buy prepared
yes,
or the ingredients
absolutely.
Ready to go?
Absolutely. There in Paris alone, there are over 30. Can you believe that? Kosher supermarkets that have everything. They're small,
mm-hmm.
but they have beautiful, the meats are beautifully prepared. You know, they're French. I mean, they're French.
But the bagels are awesome.
Well, bagels, you can't get a lot of bagels in France, I hate to tell you.
But
the bagels
they bake so well. Yeah.
But the bagels really came to France with Euro Disney.
Oh, really?
Did I read you saying, talking about baguettes being blessed as the challah? I'm not even sure what that means.
Okay, on Friday night, mm-hmm. when I was in France in the early, 70s, 60s, we had two baguettes for Friday night, and we would say the prayer
mm-hmm.
over.
And that made them challah.
Yeah, well,
kind of.
That's what challah was in the French homes. Now, of course, there's all kinds of challah.
La fille avec amour à sa rue dit bonjour et la rue extasiée la regarde passer et la rue monte toujours vers Montmartre là-haut vers ses moulins si beaux ses moulins tout là-haut rue Lepic.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking a cook's tour of the Jewish cooking of France this hour with Joan Nathan, award-winning author, 10 cookbooks to her name. Her latest comes out of a lifetime and 5 years of intensive study of Jewish cooking in France. It's called Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. He joins us today in the studio, as does the wonderful J.J. Gonson, founder of Cuisine en Locale, personal chef service who's graced us with her cooking so many times, and is a wonderful tableful here today as Jews around the world get ready to begin to celebrate Hanukkah. Let's get a call from Carl in Norfolk, Virginia. Carl, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Wonderful program as always. You're tops in my book.
Thank you.
Question, this is fascinating, but I have to ask the question, what is the similarity between Jewish cooking in France and Muslim cooking in France, since they're both Abrahamic religions and they both stay away from pork?
That's a good question.
Joan. Well, I would say it depends on where the Muslim and the Jew is from, first of all, to what they make for traditional foods. I think the difference would be Jews, they both avoid pork. The Jews avoid shellfish. They also avoid milk and meat together in one dish. So you couldn't have, I know that Muslims very often have yogurt, feel that it's like cleansing with meat. Mm-hmm. The Jews would not allow that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's different. But also, you know, there's Jewish French food. There's Jewish North African food. There's Jewish Russian food
in the markets
France.
In Paris, will you find the ingredients for each of these cuisines
for
sort
each
of,
them,
cheek by jowl together? Maybe
right.
The same.
And the same. So that you would use the same sauces, perhaps. You'd use the same. You would make couscous together if you were a Muslim and a Jew from North Africa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that the food would be similar, almost the same, but there would be nuances of difference depending on the cook, more depending on the cook than anything else, but the dietary laws as well.
Mm. Carl, thanks for your call. Let's get another Aaron in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to add to this. My wife is French. I'm Jewish American.
Mm-hmm.
And we joke all the time about the dietary similarities that she grew up with in France, that she never mixed milk and meat in a meal. It would be pain catholique. The brioche that I brought her, well, I actually brought her a challah in our first Shabbat together, which was around Passover, and it was a woven challah, but different with raisins, and she talked about how that was exactly like the brioche her father used to bring her from the Vendée, which is one of the most Catholic areas of France. And you know, I think Jewish food, in a sense, in France, is very much just French food, minus the, you know, the pork rillette.
I'm following a lot of that, and Joan is nodding along, except for no milk and meat. I mean, so many French dishes have the creamy sauces, and they're surely...
Yes, but no, and that's not how most regular French people eat that stuff, really only on special holidays. I mean, the average French person eats a lot of vegetables, very little meat, and, I mean, this is at least how we eat, and she grew up on a farm, and it's not full, the creams and sauces are wonderful, but those are for the Parisians, mainly.
Sort of ooh-la-la meals there.
Well,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, you have to have a lot of money for that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let me just, there are two points that I think are interesting. The idea, I know very often when I went to functions and people had these beautiful golden challah, because they do make challah now, even though they had baguettes when I was in France, again, after the war.
Mm-hmm.
They called them, I heard people saying, oh, that brioche is beautiful. The difference, though, of course, in challah and brioche is that in challah you do not you use oil. You don't use butter. So that's a difference. But it is of the same family. Absolutely, you're correct. I always define food in three ways. There's everyday food that we all get through, which is what that they were having every day in Vendée.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the restaurant food or the fancy food,
right,
or the way you want to you know, something for special occasions. But then there's the traditional food, the food that's brought out for Christmas, for Hanukkah, for whatever traditions that you have that are special to your family.
And we all know it, and it stands out.
Exactly, and that's the difference.
Take us on a little more of a tour here. I mean, we could go all day, but sort of a...
I'd love to.
I'm looking here. I mean, so many things look great in here. There's this goat cheese bread with mint and apricots. Now, this must be the North African tradition again, but it looks absolutely gorgeous.
Actually, this is I had this at a Tunisian woman's house in Geneva, but she's Parisian.
Okay.
And
Jewish?
Yes, absolutely. But she adapted it from Elle magazine, which you can see that they're having a North African influence. It's a lovely apricot. It's like a loaf that you serve as an appetizer warm, and each person has a tranche, a slice of it, and you eat it with your fork. Now, that's a very French thing to do. So the Americans would grab their fingers, probably.
I love the story of the salade juive, Jewish salad.
Oh, that's my favorite story.
Friends in America told you, go, you must go. There's this great restaurant. A Jewish woman owns it.
Right.
Describe the story and then the dish. It's so
gorgeous.
Okay,
well, they told me to go to a restaurant called Mas Tourneron in Gourde. I drove 2 hours to go to this restaurant, and they said that she's Jewish. So I went into the restaurant, and her name was Elizabeth Bourgeois, and I said, "Ah, vous êtes juif?" Mm-hmm. You know, I'm doing a book on the food of the Jews of France, and she said, "Pas du tout, not at all." So then we went there, and my friend and I thought, "Well, let's eat." So we ate a wonderful meal. You all must go there. And
sure, we'll be there tomorrow.
And there was this delicious tomato salad where in the heart of summer you cook down the best tomatoes. And
it's almost like a compote looking.
It's almost
again,
like
just
a compote.
Thick and dense and gorgeous.
Delicious. Color. And I tasted it and I said, "Where did you get that recipe?" And she said, "Ah, ça c'est la salade juive. That's Jewish salad." She said, "I had a Moroccan cook here for many years who made the salad for me and I've always had it."
JJ, you've been working your way a little bit through this book, sort of checking it out. I mean, what comes to mind? You do a lot of cooking in this country. Now you're looking at Joan's take on Jewish cooking in France. Does it look like, oh my gosh, this is something else entirely? Does it look familiar?
It's cool because it brings together different pieces of things that I recognize from different places. And I think it's interesting to see them together in ways that I hadn't expected them. I'm trying to think of what a good example of that is. The cake. Can we talk about the cake?
Yes, we're going to eat the cake.
What a nice segue into the cake. The cake.
This is our Hanukkah cake.
This is the gâteau de Hanukkah. And the reason I baked it in the shape I baked it in, it's in a pan that's sort of evocative of...
like a bundt pan or something. I don't know.
Yeah. It reminded me of financier, which is my favorite little French cookie, which is this little brown butter almond cookie that kind of is everywhere in every bakery.
Your Madeleine.
Right. It's my Madeleine. And I just love them. And the dough recipe, when I read it, reminded me very much of financier. So when I was looking through my limited selection of pans, this is what one of the pans that I thought I could use.
That's beautiful.
So it's like a blown-up version with fruit.
But then it's got this compote in the middle, this apple that I never would have expected to find in this relationship with this kind of pastry.
Well, let me tell you, that's perfect segue. This is a recipe originally from Poland. My mother-in-law used to make it, and I found it in America in a lot of church cookbooks in Virginia and Pennsylvania and Maryland, and it's called Jewish apple cake.
No matter if it's a church cookbook.
Right. It was always called Jewish apple cake, and I figured out why. Because there's oil in it rather than butter, because you could eat it with a meat meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the difference, what makes this French...
Keep talking, Joan. I can't resist anymore. I'm celebrating my Hanukkah.
Eat it first?
No, go on.
Okay. So
talk amongst yourselves.
I'm dying to know what makes it French.
Okay. Yeah. What makes this French is that she first tastes the apple. She makes a different... she likes to have a mix of apples. There's less flour and less sugar than in the same recipe in America. In America, everything has more flour because of all the flour companies that made us, you know,
I see. A little more than you might need.
Exactly. And sugar.
And almond flour. It has a little bit of ground almond in it, which to me is very French.
Yes.
But the other thing that I love, and I know that we're in the wrong holiday, but the apples with the walnuts, that to me is very much something that would have showed up at holiday meals.
Right. Apples and walnuts.
Why Hanukkah then? Oh, the
oil. In Passover, it's haroset. Right. You get haroset with the same combination.
Right.
I found that chop of apples and walnuts so familiar and so, to me, not French.
Right.
And
I
love this recipe. I want to do it again.
Well, it's
again.
Polish in origin.
Yeah. But she's Frenchified it. And what's so fascinating to me is this, again, this is Polish in France. We have Polish in America. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's a different take. So that we have so much processed food in America that I think that my book helps untangle the processedness of American food. For example, a cheesecake at Finkelstein's in Paris in the Marais has farmer's cheese, and I sometimes use ricotta in it. It's a crustless cheesecake. We use graham cracker crust because Joseph Kraft bought graham cracker company.
Doing fairly well, right.
And then we use his Philadelphia cream cheese. But it started out a much lighter and different cheesecake. It's crustless.
We are more Americanized, our background, than we know. And you point that out when it comes to Jewish cooking. It's just terrific. Dino, calling from Boston. You're on the air with Joan Nathan, and J.J. Gonson's here, too. Hi, Dino.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to thank Joan for the book. I can't wait to read it. I wanted to expand on a point that was made earlier about France being a melting pot. And in fact, it's an enormous melting pot. When I first started traveling through there in the 80s, I realized that there were influences on the food from everywhere. But one that hasn't been mentioned is Italy. And the cross-pollination between French cuisine and Italian cuisine is enormous. In fact, the Bourbons, who ran southern Italy and Sicily for hundreds of years, one of the most prestigious things to have in your court was a Sicilian chef. They call them manzus. So, it is, in fact, French cuisine is, in fact, an enormous combination of many cultures.
Absolutely.
And, I wanted to thank Joan for writing the book.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dino. She's nodding vigorously right here. Thank you, Dino. One more. Mizrak in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Mizrak.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I cook part-time in an Ethiopian restaurant here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And there's a very similarity with the Ethiopian and Jewish cooking. There's no shellfish, there's no pork. But I just want to ask about the vegetarian. We have everything vegetarian is vegan. You don't put anything, any cream, any milk or anything. And I just want to know how the...
You mean in Ethiopian cooking, Mizrak? It's essentially like vegan, okay.
Well, we use a lot of eggs. That's for sure. And of course, there are vegan Jews who probably lots of them go to your restaurant. But I didn't find a lot of that. There are a lot of wonderful salads and vegetables that don't have any eggs in them. But that's not what I concentrated on. And I'd love to go to your restaurant.
I'm looking here. Thank you, Mizrak, for your call. I'm looking here at a Provençal fish soup. I mean, this just looks fantastic.
It's delicious.
And here it is, and it's in a Jewish, French cookbook, but this just looks utterly French to my eye. Is there something about this fish soup? I guess it's not a bouillabaisse because there's no shellfish.
Right, exactly. Well, the difference, it's what's really interesting, I'm glad you asked that question. Bouillabaisse, and of course, I can't substantiate any of this. How can you go way back and do it? But there's something called bouillabaisse, which is like bouillabaisse. They say that the Phoenicians brought it to France, and it's exactly the same as bouillabaisse, but it's only fish. There's no shellfish. Mm-hmm. So, and a fish soup, the stock of the fish soup does not have shellfish. That's the only difference.
Oh, gosh, it's beautiful. There's the story you've got of the 13th century yeshiva teacher who sort of moonlights out with his dog hunting for truffles. Now, is that kosher?
Absolutely.
Well, I don't know.
as long as they're not the pigs, I guess. But they're not. You're not
hunting
eating
with the dog,
the
not the pig.
You're not eating the pigs. But why not? Why shouldn't truffles be kosher?
Just a kind of a fungus, mushroom, you name it.
Right. Exactly. And actually, I think that Rashi talks about truffles as well.
Is there anything archetypically French that can't? Well, there obviously are a few things that cannot be on this platter.
Oh, of course. I mean, you, all kinds of shellfish.
Mm-hmm. And all the bacons.
And all the porks, mm-hmm. You know, all that. You can't have like a blanquette de veau, mm-hmm. a cream sauce on veal. And you know, mm-hmm. the caller about the upscale food, he's correct. In the 18th century, mm-hmm. the nobility probably ate lots of sauces, but everyday people didn't. It's expensive.
And
seasonal.
Expensive and seasonal. Has this book cycled back to your French friends, French Jewish friends? What do they make of it? You, the American view of Jewishness or life have come and put it all together. Do they recognize it? Is it them? They say voila?
Well, they do say voila. I've been really surprised. I was a little apprehensive. I didn't know how they would react to it. And the reaction has been overwhelmingly positive.
JJ, you ready to adopt some of these into your fine
oh,
menus?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think it connects us. I mean, look at this one apple cake we were talking about,
yeah.
or the kugel. When I found this recipe, I thought, oh my God, this is so old. I mean, and it connects you to who you are, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. I love this also as somebody who uses local ingredients because it's absolutely in our area in season. I mean, all these apples and pears and potatoes and these wonderful things, it just glows because the food is so good right now. And Hanukkah is that time, you know, when
you want to glow.
Yes.
And glow.
Well, please try my cake.
I listen, all I want to do, talk about glowing. I'm just sitting here with yearning, looking at all this. We'll have to dig in some more.
Bon appetit.
Is fantastic. Oh, thank you, JJ Gunson, so much for bringing us this beautiful Mazel Tov. Thanks for bringing us this food. And Joan Nathan, thank you so very much for all of your searching and what you found and for bringing it to us the day before Hanukkah begins.
Thank you for having me.
Joan Nathan. Her new book is Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. We've heard in this hour, from the Klezmer tradition out of Paris. We heard from Yves Montand, Jewish singer, a pop sensation. Here our last Franco-Israeli Yael Naim, international pop star with Tunisian and Jewish parentage, singing here in homage to Paris in Hebrew. Thanks to everybody for being here. Happy Hanukkah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. המטוס נוחת ואין כבר עננים, האושר מחלחל שוב לתוכי.